WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You've developed a very unique style of choreography and theater. What about your training? Was your training as innovative as the style that you created?
Well, I suppose it was because I studied at the height of the what we now call the psychodramatic modern dance period. And, of course, this was the avant-garde of that day. But I don't know whether it was as exciting. I don't think so. Perhaps the kind of thing I do now, to me, has a lot more to it and has a lot more in the way of theatrical vision and... Also, we're much looser in subject matter. We span a much broader scope of subjects than we did then, which was mostly, psychological, psychodramatic stuff. And John Martin, the famous critic of the New York Times, the first and one of the best ones you've ever had, used to say we should have called it expressional dance, but of course we didn't. So we went under the title of modern dance instead.
Did you ever consider ballet?
No, I never did, because I started dancing after seeing Mary Wigman, the great German dancer, the great German modern dancer. And this so absorbed my attention, and I understood exactly what she was doing, even though I was country person, and I knew nothing about dance. But when I saw that, I thought this was the thing I wanted to do. And so I dug right in, and I never did go to ballet at all. Although I've taught many ballet dancers and some, you know, prima ballerinas in my time.
Dance has traditionally emphasized the differences between the sexes. That's especially true of ballet, but I think it's also pretty true of most modern dance companies. And you've really de-emphasized that in a
lot of
ways.
Because I felt really back in 1952 that the polarity of difference between masculinity and femininity was much too broad. And so I brought them almost to a unisex situation. And I did, as a matter of fact, and still in the performances and the choreography I do today, the men and the women wear the same costume. They rarely are differentiated in the costume that's worn, although the movement is sometimes different. For instance, if I choreograph for a girl, I don't believe it's suitable for a boy, for whatever reasons I can't tell you, but there is a movement difference, of course.
Why were you interested in decreasing the differentiation between male and female on stage?
Well, for several reasons. One is that we were living in an age of Madison Avenue coercion into, you know, be as sexy as you can, and we still do. We still capitulate to how sexually attractive I am. And I thought, well, this cannot be the beginning and end of dance. And also, I was interested that time in trying to redefine dance. I wanted to redefine it. And when I began to watch the female dance as against the male, I saw differences that didn't seem have to exist, that they were really indulging in erotica in their motion, and really mostly unconscious. And so I tried to clean up their act, as it were, because I didn't think it was necessary to behave always as if you were in heat, as it were, that you really could use yourself as an instrument of motion. And so reducing it to this point, I was able to see then dance as the art of motion rather than the art of emotion. And this started me off on a whole abstract exploration.
Now that has to affect the so-called subject matter of dance, too.
Oh, yes.
Since
oh, yes.
In most narrative dances, the subject is romance.
Yes. Yes, of course. But you see, there was a period right after 1952 when the whole spirit of man changed, and this was mostly because of the atomic bomb and the new theories of relativity, which involved, of course, a new assessment and visions of space and time. And so we had to go to the abstract to work in that area because space and time no longer existed in the way it existed in our concepts before. And I was eager to explore this. And having the body move as an instrument of motion rather than emotion enabled me to expand all my range of subject and activity.
In Murray Lewis's book, and he'd been a principal dancer with your company for many years, he wrote that you insisted that on stage the artists rise above the erogenous and that they don't carry their beds onto the boards.
Yes.
Now, how would you do that for dancers who were maybe used to a more erotic form of expression?
Well, in the first place, most of the dancers I used in the company had trained at the school, and this allowed me to clean it up a good deal. I felt that, you know, you shouldn't always be cursed with that look. And that there was something, I was anti-Freud at the time. I thought that there was something other than sex in life, although I enjoyed sex as much as anybody else and was by no means against it. I just thought that being compelled 24 hours a day visions and behaviorisms that suggested this was an awful waste of a lot of valuable living time.
I think of your choreography as being very sculptural, where the dancers assume moving forms. And because of that emphasis on form and on the unisex approach of the dancers, some people have referred to your dance as being dehumanized. How do you feel when that term is used about your dancers?
Well, I think it all depends on what people mean by dehumanized. If they mean fleshly-wise, yes. And of course, remember, it was a very sharp change because in the time of Isadora Duncan, which was the turn of the century, the flesh was denied very positively in ballet, for example. I mean, the body was considered vulgar, and one didn't expose it until Isadora came along and said, look, the human creature is a beautiful thing. And she began to eulogize and make known the fact that the body was not something to be ashamed of. And I'm not ashamed of it. As a matter of fact, I've done things in the nude, particularly in video in London. But the dehumanization is not a matter of physicality. It's a matter of spirit. And I think I don't dehumanize in the sense that I show the nature of the human spirit, although I do it abstractly rather than in terms of love affairs. And I've even done two of those on occasion.
Why have you done the nude dances? What interests you about dancing?
Well, the nude thing was quite by chance. I was working for BBC where we're doing an hour-long television thing, which was devoted entirely towards television electronics, and it was a piece that couldn't be done on stage. And I tried to simulate nudity by using a flesh net, but every time the camera came in close, the net was very obvious. And so the director said, well, Nick, why can't the dancers take their clothes off and do it nude? And I agreed it would have been better. So I said, well, if they let us get away with it, let's try it. And we asked the dancers first and if they would object. And the only one who objected was the only sex pot in the crowd, I think. But all the others agreed. And we called the main office, or ones that had to do with censorship at BBC, and they said, well, go ahead. We'll watch it every night, and if it gets out of hand, we'll stop it. And so it was done for the sake of an aesthetic clarity of the image of the body. And the Channel 13 or the educational television had bought into the video in London, but they didn't know they were buying a nudie, and so they could only show it in the United States here by giving it an X rating. So it's an X-rated video here in this country.
I think there's a couple of reasons why people assume that nude dance would be uncomfortable. And one is the hanging parts of men and women. For men, their penis. For women, their breasts, if they have sizable ones.
Yeah.
And also, the kicks for women would be exposing seldom exposed part of the body.
Well, it's very interesting. It's mostly frontal exposures which are difficult to contend with. But, I mean, you treat the body aesthetically rather than erotically again, and the whole thing changes. And I had long since done that. I remember teaching many, many years ago, where girl who was able to do fantastic things with her body sculpturally fascinated me, and it was extraordinarily beautiful. But I know even the young students were embarrassed by what she did, and I wasn't at all, because I saw the beauty of the figure rather than their placing a vision of the nastiness of certain parts of their body, and therefore missed the beauty of the thing itself. We've gotten over that, though, now.
Choreographer Alwyn Nicolai is my guest, if you're just joining us, and his company will be performing as part of the Dance Celebration 84 on January 6th and 7th at the Annenberg Center Theater in West Philadelphia. Now, you've also been one of the first choreographers to use electronic music, some of which you've written yourself and some of which has been written by others for your dances. Electronic music also tends to be a very non-narrative form of music.
Yes.
Why have you chosen to work with electronic music, and does it present any problems with the choreography?
No, I first worked with musique concrète and was one of the early ones to use what we call tape music, which means you captured on tape certain sounds and all kinds of sounds. You were very generous with what you considered a nice sound or a good sound or an aesthetic sound, put it on tape, and then you manipulated the tape. And the thing about this was that I was working towards abstraction. And although music is the most abstract art, at the same time, when you heard certain sounds over hundreds of years, we become accustomed to associate the sound with a literal instrument like a violin or a piano. And even that bugged me, and I didn't want to hear that. So I wanted sound to hit the ear fresh and sound like something that had never been heard before, or at least not have been heard out of habit to such an extent where you would say, ah, yes, that's a harp. And the only difficulty was that musique concrète was very hard to produce because you had to go out and find sounds all over the place. I collected a great quantity of exotic instruments from, you know, China, Japan, and from Africa and so forth. But then when the electronic music began, a man named Moog, Robert Moog, came up with one of the early synthesizers. And I bought the first synthesizer that Moog does. So it's a museum piece now. And this made composing much easier. Although I still like concrete and would like to go back to it.
When you're working with that form of music, is it easy for dancers to lose their place in the music? Or does that become irrelevant, that synchronization of music and step?
No. People have an extraordinary sense of time. I think we don't realize that. For instance, in many pieces, I don't use even a rhythmic bass. And in many pieces, too, except lately, I've been working a lot rhythmically. But prior to that, we would use sounds that just span time rather than rhythm or beat. And dancers never had any trouble with this. They would always have little cues where they would know how they were getting along with the juxtaposition of the motion with the dance and be able to hit those spots quite accurately, as a matter of fact.
Do you see dance as a form of self-expression? Since as a choreographer, what you're doing in a way is using dancers as instruments within a larger theater scene.
Well, yes. Dance is certainly a form of self-expression. In the first place, it's an art, and art is concerned with communication. And in the sense of let's say, creating a dance, you create it with the idea that it is going to be something performed and therefore communicated out of the substance of yourself. You know, just as a writer produces and creates and self-expresses on his writing tablet or typewriter, and so too the painter and the musician. Yes, we have that equivalence with the other arts for sure.
But the dancer has to really become the instrument of the choreographer. Is it a form of self-expression for them?
Well, yes, but again, it's the difference between the composer and the actual artist performing the composition the composer creates. One becomes the one who creates it, and the other becomes the interpreter of it. But the interpretation is extraordinarily important. And somehow, in interpreting the motion, one must bring to it an opinion that comes from the self. Just as an actor or an actress cannot just read "How Now, Brown Cow," they have to take a script and then offer an opinion, which the director then molds and forms into a play or whatever it might be.
Choreographer Elwin Nicolai is my guest, if you're just joining us. I have been reading a lot and hearing a lot about the problem of anorexia amongst women in ballet, of constantly starving themselves so that they can maintain that very thin figure which is desired now by many choreographers. Do you think that that has been a problem in the modern dance world as well?
No, not so much. I haven't heard about that so much in modern dance. But remember, ballet have usually have big companies, and the competition is so extraordinary there, and the business of stardom. Of course, I was anti-star oriented for a long time, and so there wasn't this thing. We do have these troubles occasionally when a dancer has been with you many years feels that he or she should be given, you know, the better roles. But we've never attempted to promote this. So there isn't that drive towards the balletic thing. And then I think, too, a part of it was that in the case of Balanchine, for example, he wanted to see the bones practically. I do like to see the substance of the body and not see it through fat. But of course, in adolescence, and of course, a lot of dance training starts during that period. Fat is accumulated naturally as a part of preparing the person for childbirth and that sort of thing. So, denying that. That process, I think, becomes very often a chore of great concern.
Since you mentioned childbirth, one dancer I was talking to said that she thought she'd never had children. I think this was Margot Fonteyn, actually. She said she'd never had children, but she felt that for women, sometimes their dancing improved after childbirth because they got so well acquainted with their body during that. Have you ever found that to be true with dancers you've worked with?
Yes. Well, it's a form of maturity, and you can't always go along. It's one difficulty with ballet. You know, they're forever being prince and princesses. They never grow up to be men and women in the mature sense, you know. And this is great, very unfortunate. For instance, you mentioned Margot Fonteyn, who still moves beautifully, but nobody choreographs for that that beautiful way in which she can move. And modern dance, of course, pays no attention to that. Modern dance goes on and doesn't always dance about youth.
Can you tell us the philosophy you've developed as a teacher?
Yes, I think so. Because I've had to search in my mind what the hell it was I was doing, and I felt that whatever my theories were or are, I speak of them as a process of decentralization, that dance is the art of motion. And even if it's ballet or tap or jazz or whatever it is the qualitative dimension that one brings to the motion that makes it a dancer great, no matter what kind. And I've worked with stars of the ballet, and it's amazing that these people always come with the stars do, because they attach emotion to some source within them that makes the motion magical. And of course, the ordinary dancer doesn't do this. So we're always, as teachers, trying to have them find the quality and the sensitivity that can emerge from a gesture. And so I always challenge my dancers, not from a physical point of view, but always making the physical the outlet for a sensation that is meaningful to them. Now, it doesn't mean that that's a literal thing. It can be quite an abstract thing, but it can speak just as beautifully as Bach is an abstract thing. You know, Bach is an abstract music, of course, says nothing in the music with barks of dogs or crying of babies, but the sound moves one very deeply. And so, too, motion can move one very deeply, even though it's not mimetic.
Do you ever have your dancers watch filmed or videotaped sessions so that they could see how they look?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, we do this constantly anyway. All my choreography is videoed. And then when the dance is recreated after a period of time, they usually resurrect it themselves by going to the video, and they'll watch themselves like hawks and then see and laugh up, you know, uproariously at some of the things they do and the way they did it. It's very good for analysis, too. But I think it has the eye of the child in the emperor's new clothes. He said, "But mother, he's naked." And the video says, "Well, really, this is what you do look like. It may make you a little dumpier than you are on stage, but it is very frank about what it is you are and the way you do it."
You had mentioned before that you've never been a Freudian, and you rejected the idea of sexual motivation for nearly every action. Are you interested in any form of psychoanalysis, and do you think that that's a useful thing to use in an art form?
No, we used to use it many years ago with students who seemed to be very disturbed or didn't know why they were doing what it was they're doing. And I would send them to have their thoughts clarified a little bit. And very often this helped. But, you know, that was at a time when we weren't so involved in that. And I must say later on I gave it up because somehow or other so many came already completely psychoanalyzed, and it didn't seem to me that the process was as effective later on. And now I don't bother with that. We work on it directly. You can look at the human body and you can see all the little fears, the phobias, the reticences, the things that hinder them from moving, all those little blocks, even the texture of the cheek or the neck. Something happens that tells you the person isn't entirely present and doesn't want to be or is frightened to be and so forth. And the dancer must be as clean as the note sounded on a concert grand. The thought must permeate every pore. And, of course, this makes for the magnificence that we know of as a human being.
But as a teacher and choreographer, you'll approach it if there seems to be a blockage or nervousness or something. You'll approach that through the motion and not through the emotional problem.
Yes, but you see, even a simple motion can be hindered by these reticences, which have already possessed the body for perhaps many, many years. You know, these begin almost after a child's 4 years old. If the child is inhibited in any way, then already the muscles begin to speak of this, and the textures begin to speak of this inhibition. And process of training, it means to try to wipe that all out and give the body as an instrument back to the mind.
Your company will be performing at the Dance Celebration 84 on January 6th and 7th at the Annenberg Center. Can you tell us a little bit about the program that's planned?
Yes, the company is now performing in Europe. We have a 14-week tour of Europe. I think they're in Nice right now. And they'll end up in Paris, and we're going to be performing here only 3 or 4 days after we leave the Théâtre de la Ville in Paris. So we'll be doing some of the works that we do there, and we'll do a short work called Pond, which was new last year, and another one, Numenon, which is an old one, goes back to 1952, and then Gallery, which is an ultra piece done in ultraviolet light, which I'm very fond of, and Mechanical Organ, which really is very good showing the emotional facilities of the dancers personally and kind of relieves the mind from the austerity of the other things and shows them a little more in their own personalities.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.